The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this Thursday evening. I'm Bruce Whitfield and back for my break. And I thank you for joining us this evening. The Money Show brought to you by APSA CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune into the APSA Insight Series podcast. That's Africanacity. APSA is an authorized FSP. It's good to be with you on this Thursday evening as we await Ghulam Belim this evening. He is the Standard Bank chief economist on the day where interest rates went up again and will go up again and probably again on top of that. We'll look at Lewis Group results, at Tsoho Sun Gaming results, at Mr. Price's results, which weren't very good at all. We'll try and solve the energy mystery, around, of course, the power supplies to the country. Stage 3 load shedding kicking in later on this evening as diesel fuel finds its way into Eskom's tanks after a mad scramble over the last couple of days. We'll talk about the agricultural economy is an important one. I mean, one of the big factors driving food, driving inflation, is food inflation at 12%. It's a big concern. We've got lots of tariffs and lots of protections in place. Should we have these tariffs and protections? Because do they do more harm than good from a consumer perspective? Also tonight, the Clicks Group has bought Sorbet. Sorbet started by Ian Furr. Ian Furr sold it to Brian Joffe's Long for Life. Brian Joffe's Long for Life sold it to Old Mutual Private Equity. Old Mutual Private Equity has now sold it to Clicks. Seems like a sensible home for Sorbet. I wonder how that is going to play out. We'll talk to Bettina Engelbrecht this evening, the chief executive of Clicks, tonight here on The Money Show. Plus, we got Pavlo Fotidis and Warren Ingram. Warren this evening, lots of questions coming through for Warren, which is great. Those questions come through on our WhatsApp line, please, or on SMS during the hours of The Money Show. It's always better because that way we get to pick them up. Warren is going to be looking at how to restructure your finances as we go into another year. And it's another year that's going to be tough. In previous years, we kind of hoped each year would get better and better and better. 2023, I think we can sort of get the very close idea that it's going to be a year in which finally all of these interest rate increases will tally up and will start to really weigh on household finances. When the lights come back on again, because we've just been load shed, I will be able to give you some stats, some figures, some data, some information as to what the status is of the current interest rate environment. Interest rates by 75 basis points. The third consecutive 75 basis point increase is what we have seen so far this year. Interest rates considerably higher than they were 12 months ago when the interest rate hiking cycle started today, roughly a year ago.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
We'll get into the great diesel mystery in just a moment, but let me just paint a picture for you as to the impact of interest rates on your back pocket over the last 12 months. If you have, and you can extrapolate this in any way that you like, whether it be half of this or twice this or five times this, whatever it might be, but if you've got a 2 million rand bond, and you've borrowed money at the prime lending rate, you are now paying an extra 4,500 rand per month compared to last November. It's significant because interest rates work on the slowly, slowly, then suddenly principle, where for the first few interest rate increases, it's a bit annoying. Your buying power is slowly eroded. They're not especially devastating in the beginning, but you wake up a year later and suddenly you realize that your ability to spend has been quite significantly constrained. The long-term effects of interest rates also, of course, matter here, because assuming interest rates stay at this level for 20 years, the difference between what you are paying for the property, the 2 million rand property today, versus a year ago are absolutely huge. Now, if you bought a 2 million rand house on the prime lending rate a year ago, over the life of a 20-year bond, you pay about 3.8 million for the house. That's what it would cost you in total, an installment of nearly 16,000 rand a month. If you did the same today, that 2 million rand house over 20 years would cost nearly 5 million rand, and you'd have a 20,000 rand a month installment. So the impact of interest rates is significant. It's nearly 1.5 million rand more over the period of the loan, with an extra 4,200 rand or so extra in bond payments each and every single month. It is a very, very significant, of course, impact. We get hold of Ghulam Belim in a bit, we hope, and chat to him all about that. But first, Eskom says that power cuts will be reduced, yay, to stage three, boo, during this evening. And that means that diesel has arrived from Petro SA this week. Sukudati Manchancha at Eskom saying Eskom will be able to reduce load shedding for now, and that the continued implementation of power cuts due to high levels of breakdowns, the usual stuff, we know this. This is Clyde Mallinson now, the energy analyst at Virtual Energy and Power. This is a crisis that surely we should have seen coming, Clyde Mallinson. You don't suddenly run out of diesel one day. Surely there should be checks and balances within Eskom to alert them that the tanks are running dry and so's the kitty.
I don't think they actually ran out of diesel. They ran out of money to pay for diesel.
Correct.
These are distinct
Same
difference.
Thing.
Yeah.
Well, so we're running out of diesel. We've budgeted 7 billion rand. Diesel prices have gone up 30, 40, 50% over the last 12 months. They should have known they would run out of money for diesel. I mean, surely that.
Yeah, I think they have. What's happened in the past, Bruce, is when Eskom have overspent their budget on diesel, they've got wrapped over the knuckles by NERSA, who say you weren't prudently spending your money. You should have got more energy out of the coal fleet. So I think it's basically Eskom throwing down something of a gauntlet and saying, okay, so we've been telling you for some time that we haven't got enough money for diesel. And every time we've told you that, you haven't allowed us to claw it back at the when we go and ask for a higher tariff. So this time, when we run out of money, we'll just stop burning diesel. And it certainly has jolted a whole lot of people into action.
One wonders who's going to have to foot the bill. Peter Bruce, who I'm going to talk to about this in a moment, has been posing the question on Twitter all day. Is this a Department of Public Enterprises expense? Is it a transit expense? I guess ultimately you and I pay for the diesel because we consume the electricity. But where's the bill going to land first?
It'll be the taxpayer. Petro SA are basically now supplying diesel to Eskom on a credit basis. So Eskom itself can't pay, but it'll then go to Treasury and say, we've just run up an IOU with Petro SA, and either you pay us to pay them or you pay Petro SA directly.
And what happens when this shipment of diesel runs out? Because, I mean, at the rate in which Eskom is burning diesel, particularly with the number of breakdowns that they are enduring on a daily basis, this 50 million rands worth, or was it 50 million litres, this big tanks of diesel don't last very long.
Yeah, Bruce, you've hit the nail on the head there. Eskom brought out a system status outlook at the beginning of September. I think they've brought out an updated one since then. And in that status outlook, in the anticipated case, they say their model shows that they are going to spend 60 billion rand a year on diesel. Not 6, not 9, not 10. But then there's a little statement that says, oh, by the way, we can't actually spend that amount of money on diesel, even if we had the money, because we logistically can't get the diesel to the diesel power generators fast enough. So when you have a look at the forecast for the future, any months where we're spending more than 2.5 billion rand on diesel, it's not actually feasible. And I'm looking at that sheet right at the moment, and there's not one month where they're spending as little as 2.5 billion. They're spending 5, 5, 6, 7, 7, 5, 7, etc. And then they say, what you will have to do then is increase the level of load shedding that we're predicting. So the model has said, if we had no fiscal constraints, this is the diesel we would burn. The reality is that even if they had no fiscal constraints, there's logistics constraints. And so they have under-calculated the amount of load shedding that we will have for the next 12 months.
It doesn't bode well. Clyde Mallinson, thank you. He is an energy analyst at Virtual Energy and Power. Listening to that, Peter Bruce, who has written, and his columns are becoming increasingly impassioned, I think that's a fair way of putting it, Peter. You're reflecting the rage that we're all feeling in your columns, and your palpable frustration seems to be how we seem to be so surprised by the many, many crises that come at us from 1,000 different directions, simply because...
Yeah.
Unlike successful countries, we just don't plan for eventualities.
No. But, Eskom telegraphs this stuff quite far ahead. I mean, they've been saying for a long time, they've basically been saying, listen, we don't have enough generating power. This, of course, occasions a lot of talk, in government and the policy options and cost powership and all sorts of others. We are trying to get renewable power on the grid, and there are various bid windows, and they've fallen behind. Bid window 5 is already a failure. Bid window 6 has now closed. It hasn't been sort of adjudicated. You know, all of the stuff is very slow, and it's kind of almost unfair to expect to run Eskom as a normal business while, asking it to do the impossible. It can't generate enough electricity. Its kit is falling over, and the diesel is really the last sort of gasp, And it comes into the country in three ways. One, it comes in at Mossel Bay. You can load the diesel into a pipeline off Mossel Bay. Comes into Saldanha, where it's transported by road down to the power station just outside Cape Town, so Rikwe at Mossel Bay, and then there's a bit of diesel produced by Sasol inland, and that's it. And what Eskom just decided to do, and I think Clyde was right, was just call everybody's bluff, say sorry, we've run out of money, and that's it. They would have known, by the way, that they were going to do this. This would have not come as a shock to them. There's absolutely no diesel on order. There's no ships with diesel on heading towards South Africa. The 50 million litres that PetroSA has found for it will soon be gone, and we'll be back where we were, on Wednesday or Tuesday. There'll be no diesel. And PetroSA itself is a failed company in the sense that it no longer refines and produces diesel. It also has to import the diesel. So it will simply be importing diesel now, and I suppose that the government's behest will simply be passing it on to Eskom so that the lights can stay on and we don't completely embarrass ourselves, when important events occur, or when rugby matches occur, or ANC conferences or whatever it might be.
That's going to be an... It's going to be an interesting one to see just how much electricity is available in that particularly important week. You were chatting to Robin Renwick the other day, Sir Robin Renwick, who's the ambassador to South Africa.
Lord,
I beg your pardon. Forgive me. Lord Robin. He was across P.W. Botha, F.W. de Klerk and Nelson Mandela as Maggie Thatcher's ambassador to South Africa. And he made the point, and I think it's been amplified and it should be amplified more, that the ANC is addicted to running everything. Government's addicted to running everything. I forget whether he made it the party or government. But this is the core of this problem that we face with Eskom, is government wants to be in charge, but you give them control, and then they mess up. And unfortunately, we all get let down by it.
Well, it's just, that's what we're trapped in. We're trapped in this thing. The only way to solve this problem is to get them out of power. And that's going to be that's a lot more difficult than it sounds. Mm. It's not simply persuading enough people either not to vote or actually to vote against them, because they'll still be left with a lot of power, even with a massive shift against them. And they are. It's not that they're addicted to centralizing power. They just don't know any other way. They don't trust the private sector. They don't trust anybody outside of their circle. And so they're incapable of imagining a different South Africa, a South Africa where the state is small but efficient and the businesses around it are empowered and free to innovate and to do business, black and white. I mean, we would transform this economy much more quickly if the ANC let go of it than they do holding on to it the way they do.
Peter Bruce, thank you. We must leave it there. Former editor at Business Day. Isaac Mtlango with us this evening, stepping into the breach on interest rates. A third 75 basis point increase in 3 months, Isaac. And the Reserve Bank governor making it very clear today, I thought, that the inflation boogeyman is far from inside his back inside his box.
Indeed, Bruce. I think it's following what we're seeing globally. where essentially the SARB is saying lower inflation is more important, which then means they will hike interest rates even if it risks moderating the economy to a very low level of growth, which is just over 1% next year. They are just making a point to say their mandate is inflation targeting. Economic growth has to be taken care broadly by other agents in the economy. And until they achieve that, they'll continue hiking. But if we look at 7%, that's their steady state, essentially the neutral rate, which means if we don't get any surprise in their inflation forecast, this is it. 7% is the peak in this hiking cycle.
But our biggest problem is food price inflation. We're going to talk a little bit about that, the constraints there, and administered prices, the sort of nonsense that's coming through as a result of a lack of planning in terms of the Department of Public Enterprises and the regulators and PetroSA and all of that stuff. I've been talking to Clyde Mallinson and Peter Bruce about this evening. The sort of inflationary impact that the state has on our everyday lives is significant. And you know, if we're going to start pointing fingers, I think this is where we should be pointing fingers more directly.
It's very significant, and they always highlight administered prices as an upside risk, essentially telling their colleagues across government to say, should you continue to hike these administered prices such that the risk or inflation profile going up, we will continue to hike. I think that's one of the messages that we get, which when they say we still have upside risk to inflation, it's coming from wages. Government employees are still about to strike for that. Also, electricity prices. Eskom has asked for an arm of an increase in tariffs. And then we have all the other government agencies that would also be increasing their prices, which go directly into pushing inflation upwards. So those are the risks that might add further to the interest rate hike beyond the 7%. But I think if we don't see any of those materializing, 7% is it.
Thank you. Azam Tlanga stepping into the breach this evening, Executive Chief Economist at Alexander Ort, Alex Forbes, as it's now known.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Rudy van der Merwe, are you as confident as Azam Tlanga on interest rates? Is this as high as they go? I see more consensus views of at least another 100 basis points into the new year. What's your view?
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, I think we probably will see some more. Hopefully the rate starts slowing down. And I think if the market can start believing that we closer to the end, then we can start looking through this to what comes next and how quickly we are able to start reversing the situation. There's a lot of unknowns, unfortunately, and this one of them is obviously wages and the extent to which that spirals into a second round inflationary impact. And then probably the single biggest driver of inflation anyway is the oil price. And that seems to be moderating a little bit of late. It does also seem like there's a hope that we might be starting to, or that the world might be in a position to get some Venezuelan oil not too long from now. And if that is the case, and then that starts to increase supply, hopefully we could see inflation starting to moderate globally, which would be very useful. But just for the moment, I don't know that I'm fully confident that we've seen the peak quite yet.
But money is coming out of consumers' pockets at an alarming rate. Now, I used the example of a 2 million rand mortgage earlier. It's costing you 4,500 rand a month more to service a 2 million rand mortgage than it was a year ago. So that's coming through in certainly Mr. Price today. It's certainly coming through in Lewis Group results today as well. Certainly, these are companies that are very well managed, very well run, very effective businesses. But if fewer people are coming through your doors with less money in their pockets, well, there's less to spend and fewer profits to be made.
Absolutely the case, Bruce. And both of them are clearly feeling that and talking quite seemingly concerned, seem very concerned about the outlook for consumer spending, talking about consumers being under pressure, a lot more demand for credit sales than there was before. And that's a theme that comes through in both businesses. And then clearly margin pressure on them and consumer spending. So one can see sales in Lewis are growing at a lower rate. And one would expect that as well. It's durable goods, so it's more easy to delay the purchase of things like furniture than it is possibly clothing. And Mr. Price's clothing division is doing a lot better than its other businesses. So apparel sales are up at about 8.5%, as opposed to homeware, which was actually down slightly. And I think that's partly due to competition, but probably also due to the same situation where you can put off homeware purchases probably for longer than you can essential clothing.
Oh, I don't know.
But I talk about pressure.
You must come around. I'll show you my cupboard. I'll show you putting off clothing purchases. but yes, Rudy Funamadwa, apologies for cutting you a little bit short this evening, but thank you, Rudy Funamadwa. We also had results today from Tsokosan Gaming. No problems there. The business is flying, sharp recovery. And Stefanuti Stocks also seeing a nice ramp up in its share price. One of these last sort of survivors, I suppose, of the South African construction sector, picking up work as it goes along. Share price today up 6% on the day to 1 rand and 3.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune in to the Absa Insight Series podcast. That's African Asity. Absa is an authorized FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield, and we're going to be talking about food prices in just a little bit and imports of food. That's absolutely critical, of course, as we go into a festive season where we like to treat ourselves, but there's less money in the household budget. 4,500 rand less for every 2 million rand worth of mortgage debt that you have versus this time last year. So certainly households are more constrained than ever. And governments everywhere put tariffs on imports to protect certain industries. In some cases, they'll have free trade agreements with some countries and not others. And usually it's for their mutual benefit. But we recently saw tariffs on chicken imports suspended because prices were rising so fast. Government decided it was more prudent to protect consumers over the industry, of course, that the tariffs were designed to protect. And now I see anti-dumping tariffs on frozen potatoes, so frozen chips, have actually pushed up prices for South Africans. And Tapile Ngunjana is the agricultural economist at the National Agricultural Marketing Council. Tapile, talk to me, please, about this importing of frozen chips. Potatoes, of course, Burger King came to South Africa, they told us they had to import chips because the special coating they put on their chips only came from Belgium. But we produce a lot of potatoes in South Africa, and this potato industry here demanded some protection, I think, from imports, but it's actually pushed the prices up very, very significantly.
Hi, Ross, and thanks for having me. We are currently having an serious issue around the frozen potato prices, and this is, of course, something that we anticipated, when the ITEC announced that they're going to be, putting in some anti-dumping tariffs on that. And that is, of course, I mean, there was a reason behind that. We don't want to avoid that. It is a valid reason that they brought that. Okay, of course, we are not a very huge industry, and then when we are as a producer in South Africa competing with farmers from like very subsidized countries, it becomes a problem for the local producers, which is where this stance came from in terms of protecting the local producers. But of course now that it has adverse consequences for the buyers, South Africans, they like their chips, and at the moment we are having a relatively lower supply of those, which is why we have seen a relatively increase in prices for specifically for frozen potatoes, but for fresh potatoes, that's not a problem. Actually, we have
And here's the thing. So here, I mean, I can solve the frozen chip problem quite easily. Peel the potatoes, chip them yourself, and stick them into the deep fat fryer. I know it takes a bit longer, but for goodness sake, this is a consumer rather than an inflation or tariff problem. It's just that we're not smart enough to find alternatives, is, I guess, what's going on here.
Yeah. No, I mean, of course, this is not a very straightforward kind of a situation. But I think, especially now, also given that now, I think today also we just seen that interest rates have been at a height. Of course, consumers are being put in a far worse position. So when things like these happen, of course, they're adding to things that we're already having. So as much as we would like to, I think at least from the ITEC's point of view and also the industry guys, is that We probably maybe we can just have from time to time to see when we are having, you know, maybe reduce the time of having anti-dumping. When we say, okay, the prices are going up, then we can quickly, you know, put in the brakes on our anti-dumping and then reduce those so that we can have supply and all that. But of course, these things, they take time in terms of, you know, sometimes there's going to be a period to see adjustments in prices going to the lower equilibrium, or maybe, you know, just taking a bit lesser time than we normally do. So, you know, those are just the dynamics that are always there when we're talking about this. But of course, it is not a straightforward kind of a thing. And I mean, we are consumers, of course, at the same time, we do feel that when this happens.
I generally don't talk about what I do in my off time, but I was overseas yesterday, and I had a burger and chips in a well-known burger joint in London. And on the board next to where you place your orders, they said, today's chips come from XYZ Farm in Lancashire. And stacked around in the shop are pockets of potatoes, 20-kilogram pockets of potatoes, big bags of potatoes. So these guys, I mean, they get the potatoes straight from the farm into the stores. Yeah. They peel them themselves, chip them themselves, and fry them themselves. It is possible. Do we just need to get rid of our addiction of frozen chips and just do a little bit of work ourselves, perhaps, and then we solve this particular problem?
Absolutely. That's something that, I mean, recently I was talked to this thing. We somehow we have to move away from, you know, the general norms and just try to do things differently when the norms that are normally not necessarily working. I think that's something that you can always explore in terms of making sure that, okay, we are having enough potatoes in our shops. I mean, it's something that the countries they've done in a number of years, especially for the other fresh potatoes that we get in 10 kgs, we have actually had a surplus on that. But the issue that now we need to address is specifically for the frozen products. Well, of course, that has to do with the varieties that are also produced. Because in South Africa, most farmers, they produce the potato varieties that are suitable for, you know, for the ones that you'll get at the bag, 10 kg, 1 kg, but not for the frozen ones that are normally found in those big, you know, retailers where you go to your restaurant and all that. Sorry,
Tabile, I need to go. Agricultural economist at the National Agricultural Marketing Council, Tabile Nkunjana. And yeah, it says, I mean, my household is as guilty as I'm purporting to be so pure and innocent on this particular one. But yeah, we buy frozen chips because it's convenient. Absolutely, convenience is there. But going into this burger joint yesterday, and best chips possibly, I don't know about ever, but really good chips, made fresh in the back of the store, from potatoes, brought it in pockets in the store. No frozen nonsense coming through there. I mean, I look at stories like this and I go, come on, it's our fault, no one else's. You know, we can moan and minge and bow about it, or we can simply buy a couple of potatoes, chop them up ourselves, deep fry the damn things, and there we go. You can get your chips that way and eat them.
Aubrey Masango.
Weekday evenings.
8 to midnight.
What are you grateful for?
Hi, Simbi.
Grateful that 2005, I survived an accident where four of my colleagues died. Mm. I had only fractured arm.
Palisa.
I am grateful for the goodness of God in my life.
Come on now.
And when I think about the goodness of God in my life, and I'm like, wow, there is indeed a God, given everything that I've went through and everything that I've survived, is still a God, and He is such an amazing person in my life.
Aubrey Masango.
8 to midnight on 702.
702.
Financial year end coming up. Want to create real social impact through youth jobs? Get your triple BEE boost through Youth Employment Service. Yes, today, and gain up to 2 levels on your scorecard almost immediately in your first year. Witness the country and your company thrive through your investment in SA Youth. Say yes. Visit yesforyouth.co.za to register. That's yes, the number 4, youth.co.za.
Grow your business. Get more space, get more locations, get more markets. With Old Mutual Funding for Business, we look beyond your credit record to assess the real potential of your business and give you what you need to grow. Apply today at oldmutual.co.za. Get ahead of life with funding facilitated by Old Mutual Corporate Ventures. Old Mutual. Do great things every day. Old Mutual Corporate Ventures is a company within the Old Mutual Group of Companies. T's and C's apply.
Every day is Black Friday at Rochester, and it's a perfect time to save thousands. Save up to 30% on selected furniture right now. Wowee, that's incredible. Choose from a stylish range of quality furniture and save up to 30%. It doesn't get better than that. Don't miss out. It's not just furniture. It's Rochester.
KwaZulu-Natal is open for business. The KZN Department of Economic Development, Tourism and Environmental Affairs has strived to position the province as a destination for investment and trade. This is all part of MEC Siboniso Duma's program to celebrate 100 days in office, and he will lead a business expo in Indaba this Saturday. Tune in to Weekend Breakfast from 6 a.m. when we come to you live from the Ugu Sports and Leisure Center and share more of the new opportunities that await businesses and investors. 702, let's walk the talk.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
I'm not a big believer in the fact that you speak about something near a device that could perhaps overhear you and then send you content related. But I can't recall ever seeing potato-related content in my Twitter feed. I couldn't. I don't. And suddenly I'm being fed Twitter content, and it's brutally cruel Twitter content of deliciously fluffy mashed potatoes with gravy. Potato recipes feed. Coincidence or not? Anyway, lots of venues and event spaces really are not bouncing back from the pandemic. There aren't as many events, aren't as many conferences. The big convention venues, I think, are back to almost normal. It was certainly, if you go to the Sandton Convention Centre on any day of the week, it seems to be busy or preparing for a big event, or the Cape Town International Convention Centre, very, very busy. Lots of big events coming back. But it has created an opportunity for Blanche Franken, who's the co-founder of Everyspace. And if you found Blanche in your work, that there are just many event spaces that are wonderful and hugely applicable to many events that aren't on the top of people's agendas anymore. And you've kind of created an Airbnb for venue spaces, is my understanding.
Hi, Bruce. Yes. So we've been dubbed the Airbnb of film and event spaces. But we've really seen the concept really came from, we launched within the COVID pandemic itself. I mean, as we know, marketplaces are really a recession-proof business model. So from back then, we've really focused on film sites, straight through film. We've seen productions continue. But on the hosting side, we've particularly seen people willing to rent out their homes, earning a second income, earning up to 14,000 Rand a day. Hosting, and I mean, at the end of the day, you as a host can stay in your property, you don't need to leave your property, you only give it up for a certain amount of hours. But on your question, in 2022, we've really seen an uprising. We're open to conferences, events, off-sites. We've seen almost double the bookings we have this year than we did compared to 2021.
And what's dominating? I mean, I recall going to a corporate event once where a house in the northern suburbs of Johannesburg with a huge garden and a beautiful outdoor area and a wonderful pool had been rented by a financial services company that had invited 14 people, 7 couples, to come and have dinner. And then there were chefs and sommeliers and all sorts of wonderful things going on. It's that sort of event that sort of can be a personal, quite intimate event, or if you've got a big house in Sandhurst that you're struggling to pay the rates and taxes on, you could always make it available, I suppose, via a platform like this.
That's correct. I mean, we cater for properties across the board, from commercial spaces. We have some of the top hotel groups. We have Ocular. Then we have residential spaces ranging from villas to dilapidated small homes. Then we have studios on the other side. So what we've really seen predominantly on the residential side is film shoots, fashion shoots, commercial productions. And then on the event side, we've had, obviously, we're on the year-end function train currently, but that's mostly on the commercial side. On the residential, we've seen some conferences, some rooftops. We've seen some workshops being held at larger residential spaces. We've seen a real adoption to smaller intimate. It's what every space focuses on, booking by the hour, ranging from 10 to 20 to 30 attendees, nothing much larger than that. So we've really seen people adopt to the residential side of that as well, making things as intimate as they possibly can.
From a film industry point of view, things are picking up in the movie industry. Of that, there is absolutely no doubt. And there are lots of fantastic venues. I recall going to a property near Caledon. And that wasn't near Caledon. It was up the west coast, north of Cape Town. About 3 or 4 years ago, and sort of feeling, I've been here before. I've been to this place before. I know I've been here before. And it was the Kenya scenes in the first series of The Crown, and they'd hide this fantastic farmhouse that was of an era that could have been in Kenya in the 1930s, and they'd hired this place, and it'd be that sort of venue, I suppose, that says, you know, we can be colonial chic 1930s or whatever if you need us. That sort of venue would also find a home on the platform.
Sure thing. We built initially the EverySpace platform on accessibility, especially from a property owner point of view. We've seen small residential spaces of hosts that would never have imagined having their space in a movie or a film, and they've had more than 15 bookings on the platform, and they've been amazed by why film crews want to shoot in my space, but it just matches the vision so perfectly. So the EverySpace platform really caters towards unique spaces. And I think that is the key term when it comes to filming locations, especially, is every filmmaker has a unique vision, and you don't know if your space catches that or matches that vision or not. So that's what we've seen on the residential side from property owners who've said, we never even thought of putting our space up for film. And now we have a film crew in our home. We see our home on the screen, and that just amazes them.
It's amazing, and it's a wonderful idea. Blanche Franken this evening, thank you, co-founder and head of product at EverySpace. It's a platform, a bit like an Uber, but like many of the platforms that exist in order to provide for the gig economy, like an Airbnb for venue spaces. A fabulous idea. Blanche Franken this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Money Show brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune into the Absa Insights Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. We'll chat to Bertina Engelbrecht in a moment, the chief executive at Clix. Clix announcing today that it is buying Sorbet, the beauty business. Before that, a story breaking this evening on News 24. I've asked my producers to see if they can find somebody to give us a bit more detail. But a court in Germany announcing that the accounting fraud trial of Markus Juster, the former Steinhoff chief executive, will start early next year. It'll happen in the Oldenburg Regional Court. No date is set as yet, but the case is due to begin. And this is massive. This is a very, very, very big step, of course, because the case is being waited a long time for justice on this particular one. We know the huge forensic reports into Steinhoff. We know that there are confessions of misdeeds in Steinhoff. And remember when we spoke to the trustee of Markus Juster's trust, one of Markus Juster's trusts, who says he would like to see justice. Well, it's getting justice. And certainly we told that Markus Juster's South African lawyer has not replied to any request for comment at this stage. But yeah, good. Let's get the matters ventilated. Let's do that.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Clix is going to acquire Sorbet. Now, Sorbet started out as a startup by Ian Furr, who's a remarkable entrepreneur. He really is. He started Sorbet as a beauty chain, and he consolidated the sort of backyard beauty parlors that he was seeing all over the place and hadn't been corporatized, hadn't been systematized. And so he created this concept. I think he regretted the name for a while because people thought, oh, ice cream. Oh, it's not ice cream. I don't want my nails done. Thank you. I just want an ice cream. But then you get used to the name, and it's done very well. He then sold out to Brian Joffe's Long for Life. Long for Life then sold that business into Old Mutual Private Equity. Old Mutual Private Equity has just sold it to Clix. Bettina Engelbrecht is chief executive at Clix Group. And you've been carrying the Sorbet products on your shelves for a long time, Bettina. There's been a partnership of sorts almost since the beginning, I think.
Absolutely so. Since before that, Sorbo became an affiliate partner to our Club Card loyalty program. 2015, of course, we acquired 25% of the intellectual property of Sorbo Brands, and our own product development team have been working very, very hard in terms of the development and innovation of Sorbo products and Sorbo brands.
Okay, and of course you are also the owners of the Body Shop in South Africa. You are the franchise holders of the UK Creative Body Shop in Click. So, I mean, this is part of, I suppose, the long running part, the beauty part of health and beauty part of Click.
Absolutely, part, you know, an absolute extension of the beauty portion of our vision to really be preeminent and market leading. And Sorbo, of course, fits very, very well with that because it's the leading professional beauty treatment salon franchise in South Africa. And of course, the Body Shop, you know, you think back to the 1960s when Dame Anita Roddick started the Body Shop on environmentally friendly, attributes. And of course, it's just been an absolutely remarkable story, very far ahead of its time. And we, of course, have been always so proud of our license to operate the Body Shop brands in Southern Africa.
Is there going to be like a mini Body Shop, as you've done pharmacy in every single Click store? Do you look at the possibility of a Sorbo coming into the Click stores, or do you leave them as standalone outlets? At the moment, 190 franchise outlets across South Africa. I think there's Candy and Co, which is more aimed at ethnic care and treatments. The Sorbo Man, and of course the traditional Sorbo core of the business. Is there an opportunity to expand into your spaces, or is that just make it too complicated?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, first of all subject to Competition Commission, and so we would be very careful not to take any preemptive action. Of course, Sorbo brands are being sold within all of the 850 Click stores. In fact, it's how about that number. I just went, I think, last week to open up number 850 in Umhlanga. And so, you know, that's something that will continue. And of course, the extension of the brand will continue as well. Of course, Sorbo, operates a franchise model. And there's a huge benefit in having entrepreneurial-minded, passionate, mainly women actually who run these Sorbo salons. What that does is it creates a remarkable halo for the Sorbo brand, and of course facilitates the introduction of salon products, first of all into Sorbo, but then, you know, in time perhaps into the Click brand as well. But the important thing is the Sorbo franchise owners can look to even more investment in the development of exclusive Sorbo brands.
Okay, so the franchise model doesn't change. So if you're a Sorbo franchisee, you've been through quite a mill actually, because you had Warm and Fuzzy Ian Fur, and then you had Brad Joffe, who's a lot more sort of bottom line focused, and then Old Mutual Private Equity, and you might have thought that they would hold on for 7 years, and now they've been thrust into Click. They've not had much choice in this particular process, as they've gone through probably quite a roller coaster. And what sort of assurances can you give them in terms of what their future looks like as franchisees within a Click's context?
It would be fair to say, you know, that we're a business that has got a very, very strong capital management strategy. And so you would know that in terms of our decision to acquire the, you know, 100% of the Sorbo Group, it's ultimately based on whether or not we see that there's a future for the brand and whether or not we can add value to further growth in that brand. We believe that Sorbo will be value accretive to ourselves. And importantly, for Sorbo itself, the owners of the salons who are entrepreneurs, that business of theirs will continue to expand, and that we will most certainly support the expansion of their businesses and add value wherever we are able to do so.
Thank you, Bettina Engelbrecht, the chief executive at Click Group this evening. 105 million rand is the price tag for the Sorbo Group. Hopefully bring some stability for the franchisees. I think there's been a fair amount of chopping and changing, and that's never very comfortable. So out of Ian Fur's control into Long for Life's control, into Old Mutual Private Equity, and now into Click's, hopefully things settle down on that particular front.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Small Business Feature brought to you by Old Mutual. Visit oldmutual.co.za. Old Mutual, do great things every day. Pavlo Fatidis, building a business backwards. Now, Pavlo, I'm trying to build a business forwards, and that's hard enough.
It is, isn't it?
Yes. Why? Does building it backwards make it easier? Because if that's the case, I'm in.
Yeah, it does. It does. You know, Bruce, this, during the course of today, I met with this business owner, and I was sharing a story with them about another business owner that we've done some work with that just sold his company for $120 million. It's a big number, right?
Yep, it's huge.
What would you do with it?
Don't do this to me. I ask the questions.
So what was the response I got? And it was very annoying and disappointing, but and completely expected. He says, he's a really, really lucky person. And Bruce, it's got very, very little to do with luck. Now, sure, there are some factors where luck plays in. And, you know, Warren Buffett said there were three things that really he couldn't have controlled that have placed him in a very lucky outcome. One of them was that he mentioned was that he was born in the United States, which has a big market. It's entrepreneurially orientated, the vibrant economy. So yes, where you are matters, you know, different countries have different economies. The time and period of life matters. Certainly it was easier to raise, for example, venture capital and to make money out of venture capital 15 years ago than it is today, and so on and so forth. But largely, it has very little to do with luck, because if you build your business backwards, it means that you design what the business today to give an outcome that you've identified for that future.
Pavlo, I'm going to ask our producers to give you a call on the phone, because it does sound, and we had this problem about a month or two ago, and I did ask somebody who works with you whether you've been punched in the mouth because you've been lisping, and I was told it was a microphone setting. So I'm asking my producers to get you on the phone rather, because it's undermining your credibility. Not that anybody with a lisp is under, you know, does lacks credibility, but Pavlo is a clear communicator. And so, unfortunately, what happens is there's a microphone setting somewhere in the ether of his thing, and this becomes a bit distracting eventually. And so we've asked the producers to give him a call on the phone and to do that, because I think it would sound just a little bit better, because we don't want to be laughing at Pavlo's very serious information. So the producers are frantically now trying to raise Pavlo on the phone. I wonder if he's still got a phone, because he's so used to Zoom calls and appearing in person nowadays. And that's what we're going to be doing this evening, is catching up with Pavlo Fatidis. Building your business backwards. This idea that you can meet a, you can create a business, you can build your business over time. But this idea of doing it backwards is, I think, the important one that Pavlo is going to land with us this evening. Pavlo Fatidis is the founder and the boss, one of the bosses. He's got a very good business partner in the business. And they have built this business over the last 15, 20 years. And it is it started off as a business incubator and now helping people accelerate growth within their businesses. This is the goal of what they're seeking to achieve. Pavlo, pick up the phone. Pick up the phone, Pavlo. What we've got as well coming up this evening, the switch, like, so it's fine. So, Pavlo, are you with us on your, where are you? Are you still on Zoom?
Yes, I am. And I've switched mics, so this should be a lot better.
It is. You're back to yourself. Okay, excellent. There we go. it did sound silly at one point, so I just tried to avoid that. So, Pavlo, talk to me about this reverse engineering a business then.
Well, so this particular business, Bruce, that sold itself very successfully for $120 million, there's a backstory here, and the backstory begins about 8 years ago. When I met this particular business owner, I said, look, you know, what are you hoping to achieve at the end of the day? And he said, no, look, I want to sell my business one day. And I said, okay, that's a very good start. You know, the fact that you're looking to build a business that, yes, will earn you income now and towards that end game. But a good setting, a good idea is to think about what the final end game is, and that's going to be a sale. And then I asked him, well, how much do you want, do you think, for the business at that point in time? And he turned around and he said, $100 million. That's my number. and it's a number that gets used a lot. You know, it's not 8 digits, it's 9. It's nice and round. And in many ways, it suggests quite a remarkable achievement. In fact, after years and years and years of investment and risk and sacrifice. So the target was set. And then the plan to act tomorrow had to be built from that future date backwards. And we ran a few numbers. And what we calculated is that 5 years forward, he would need to have a revenue of 85 million. His profitability would need to be at least around 15%. And he would have to be able to argue and justify a multiple of around 8. So if you take your 85 million, you multiply it by 15%, you times it by 8, you're going to come in and around 100 odd million.
How many businesses, though, Pavlo, are sold on a multiple of 8 times? I think in a small business context, if you get 2 or 3 times, you're doing well, aren't you?
Very much so. Very much so. On average, most businesses are lucky to earn a 3 or 4 multiple. But the reason for that is that when most people sell their businesses, Bruce, they arrive there at the 11th hour after 10 or 20 or 30 years of successfully generating income and learn that what they have built is a business that's good at generating income, but not a business that is transferable as an asset to the future buyer or a future acquirer. And for that reason, they get punished heavily on the multiple. So the multiple is an indicator that effectively answers 5 questions. It says, yes, okay, you're in the furniture business. There are 10,000 furniture businesses out there. And we can see that you've distinguished yourself, that you have identified a clear set of customers. You've got growth within those customers. Your brand is recognized within those customers. Beyond furniture, you have a brand, and that brand talks to the impressions that the customers you sell to have and hold towards your company. So that's the one factor that would take your, let's call it 3 multiple to a 4 multiple. The next question is, how does the whole thing work? And I'm sorry to use this word again and again, every show we do, Bruce, but
system.
If you have translated all your commercial activities into business systems, in effect, what you're saying is you've got a playbook as to how the business works. Show that, demonstrate that, an additional multiple. Now we're sitting from 4 to 5. The third thing they will ask is, well, okay, without you there, who's going to make it happen? And if you can show that you've got a team that's engaged, that's motivated, that has been there for some time, that sees a future, especially with the new acquirer, you have an additional multiple. And then the last two elements that they question is, well, will there be growth in the future? And here's the thing. You know, to argue that there's growth in the future that's going to show growth at a far higher rate than you've enjoyed in the past never, never holds water. Because any acquirer of the business says, well, you know, if I'm going to grow the business at a higher rate than you've grown the business in the last 2-3 years, I'm not going to pay for that. You know, that's coming from my risk, my investment, from the sweat and bend of my body and back. You need to have shown growth prior to exiting. And then the last and often the toughest question is, okay, Bruce, without you there, what happens to your suppliers? What happens to your team? What happens to your customers? What is your influence in holding it all together and ensuring that the asset I'm buying from you today will be the same asset performing tomorrow once you have left? If you address each of those 5 levers, you're taking your 3 multiple to an 8 multiple. You're adding an additional point in each and every instance. And that's what I mean by an engineered approach, which requires you to start with the end game saying, I want 100 million rands for my business. Let me calculate my revenue. Let me calculate my profit. And I'm going to peg it at an 8 multiple because I will design the business to deliver that 8 multiple.
It's so important, Pavlo, this idea of being able to divorce yourself from the business and the ability for the business to run itself so that when it is sold, the people who are still in the business are an asset to the new owner. And the new owner doesn't, and they're no longer saying, well, what would Pavlo have done? It's a case of actually the system runs it. The system runs it. We run ourselves. We are, you know, it's a little bit disheartening for your ego because you built this out of your blood, tears, and sweat. Mm. You've got the 100 million. You know, you've got the 8x multiple or whatever the case might be. You're home dry. Everyone else in that business actually still requires the business for an income. The new owners want to generate a profit over time. So get your ego out the way. Get the thing systematized and processed and ensure that there's an asset of value to sell. See, I listen.
Completely. And you know, Bruce, there's so much research that's been done over the years around why acquisitions fail to yield value for the acquirer. It's estimated around 82% of acquisitions made, and this was conducted in a Harvard study in around 2016, about 82% of acquisitions made fail to yield value for the buyer. Very often these acquisitions are made by listed companies where there's quite a bit of pressure to demonstrate how your investments are yielding shareholder value all the time. What was interesting in it is they identified four main reasons why these acquisitions fail. The first is a misalignment of customers. You know, you acquire a business, you believe you might be deepening your ability to reach a new market that's similar to the market you already serve, and often there's a misalignment there. The next is that there are massive issues integrating the team in the acquired business with your team. In other words, getting cultural matches done. The third reason is that the functions of how that business runs and operates are profoundly different to the way how your business runs and operates. And the final reason is that once the owner is no longer there, the culture, the values, the issues that held everything together simply disassemble, fragment, and fall away. So understanding that when you're ready to exit a business means you are serving and understanding the needs of a new customer, this thing called a buyer. The problem is that most of us arrive there with maybe 3, 4, 5, 6 months, because at that point we want to get out, we've made the decision to get out, and yet we have never built the business in such a fashion that it fits neatly with what that buyer wants.
Start with the end in mind and build it backwards. Pavlo Fotidis, Small Business Focus on a Thursday evening. Building a business backwards. Pavlo Fotidis is the founder at Auric Business Accelerator.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune into the Absa Insight Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal Finance with Warren Ingram.
Personal Finance brought to you by Toyota Financial Services. Toyota Financial Services is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply. Warren Ingram, Executive Director, Galileo Capital, and a personal financial advisor with us again. And I don't know if you remember back to 2019, Warren. I was like, going, oh, goodness me, I can't wait for the year to end. 2020 is going to be so much better. We then get into COVID, and it's like, oh, 2021. I can't wait for 2021. Get to the end of 2021. It's like, oh, thank goodness it's 2022. I don't know. We've got this weird sort of mapping of our lives year on year on year. And each one of the years that has gone by in the last five has been, you know, significantly challenging. And as we look towards 2023, I'm going, I'm too scared to look at 2023. It's been, you know, it's got worse and worse and worse. But you're going to help us through that, I hope.
I'll do my best. And maybe the one thing to give you a little bit of peace of mind about where we are right now is it feels a little bit from an investment point of view that the world is starting to turn the right side up. I feel the world kind of went a little bit upside down, you know, after 2008, 2009, when especially the central banks in the US and Europe started to cut interest rates on such a long and sustained basis that you eventually got to the point where it cost you a fortune just to store money in a bank, and it wasn't in fees, it was in interest that the bank was charging you to give the bank money. And for me, that was, you know, I mean, all my economics and finance textbooks, they weren't designed for that kind of a situation. Yeah. So what we're living through now, Bruce, is kind of the world, you know, righting itself. The ship is going from, you know, being completely upside down where, you know, the propeller is in the air and everything else is underwater. And now all of a sudden we're right side up. The ship is certainly not going in any direction. It's just bobbing around at the moment. And that's very unsettling. But we can start to do some calculations and we can start to understand how this world works and the medicine that the world is busy taking now, which is rising interest rates to combat inflation. All of those things for us as South Africans is pretty normal. It's pretty usual stuff. It's things we understand very well, which also means we know how this story starts to unwind. All the bad news and kind of the, if it's a story at the moment, it's a horror story. But I think we know what the light at the end of the tunnel will be, and it's not a train. It's you know, the end of inflation and then the result that reserve banks around the world and in our country, firstly, will stop raising interest rates and then at some point start to reduce interest rates and take the pain, some of the pain out of the economic system. All of that is, I think, good news for us because we're not in a situation where we're dealing with a pandemic or the collapse of the financial system, which is what we were dealing with in 2008, where we were all eventually very worried that the world might end in a financial term. This is kind of normal stuff. This is a normal market cycle, and we know how cycles go in this environment. So Long story short, I think we're okay.
Okay, but there is, you know, this idea that there should be a rebound, and the JSE's recovered remarkably, actually, over the last 3 months, even as the news cycle, the news flow in South Africa has got darker and darker and harder, markets have recovered quite nicely to about 72,000-73,000 on the All Share Index. So as we then look into 2023 and beyond and say, okay, so, you know, interest rates are likely to be peaking. They make up once or twice more. Inflation doesn't immediately recede back down to the 2% target rate, which is what central banks in Northern Hemisphere countries like. It may take some time for that to occur, but markets are likely to respond in anticipation of that fact. And so we could actually have a pretty good 2023, is I think what I'm hearing you say.
Except for the very last part around timeframes, I think that's maybe the mistake we've been making from 2019, 20, and then 21 is we kept putting quite short timeframes on when things will get better. I agree with you that the markets will look forward and start to anticipate you know better days ahead. But you know whether that happens at the end of this year, the end of March next year, or June. I think we need to just kind of say to ourselves, we're in it now. We're probably, you know, if we're not at the bottom of the pit, we're very close to the bottom. Let's just, you know, not make big decisions based on the world will get better by March, and let's start investing according to that. I think it's just a case of saying, for now, this is probably as close to the end of the bad news as we're going to get, and then let's wait for the good news. What worries me a little bit about global markets and maybe in South Africa as well is that fund managers and investors are kind of, if I have to use another an analogy, you know, we're driving our cars and we're starting to put our foot on the accelerator quite hard in terms of getting excited about things might get a lot better a lot sooner. So the car's accelerating, but the only way we're driving and the only place we're looking is in the rearview mirror and looking at that rearview mirror to help us decide whether to turn left or right. And I think that's really dangerous. So, you know, the one thing we've always got as private investors making our own investment decisions is we don't need to be part of the kind of fund manager herd and the kind of mass hysteria, whether it's, you know, good news or bad news or whatever the deal is. We can make our own decisions. And I think that's my real big comment for people now is just take a bit of time. Don't make big decisions either way. You know, if you're really kind of bleak about the markets and super pessimistic, that's okay. I mean, you know, we have reason to be, but that doesn't mean that there is no good news on the horizon. Equally, if you're kind of, you know, the glass is like 90% full all the time kind of a person, maybe just hang on a bit and be a little bit slow to kind of jump on the bandwagon and accelerate your investment portfolio in anticipation of a lot of growth next year. I'm hopeful that that's the case, but I'm certainly not going to commit money for that direction. And maybe it's kind of a long-winded way to say, you know, if you've got a decent kind of selection of investments and you've got a nice spread of investments, don't become too optimistic, too pessimistic now, and be very slow to make big decisions and big changes now. I think, you know, patience here and a bit of fortitude in terms of not panicking and is good, but equally don't kind of get caught by, you know, the first big prediction. I think we're already getting it from some of the big fund managers saying, gee, the Rand's going to be a 15.50, you know, in next year, and you know, everything's going to be amazing. It might be, but you don't need to invest according to a prediction. You can wait and see how the story unfolds a bit.
Okay, good. I think we've covered the bases there. We've got quite a long voice note that's come through from Wentworth this evening. My only request is I want to play the whole of Wentworth's voice note. I'm told it's very good, but it's quite long. Please, we'd love your questions, and we'd love you to do what Wentworth has done. We'd love you to do what somebody else has done this evening and send us an emailed question. But please keep them as short as you can. Voice notes tend to allow people the space to ramble a little bit. I don't think Wentworth rambles. So let's have a listen to Wentworth's question and then come back to that answer with that. And a question that says, my portfolio, local and offshore, has taken quite a knock since the start of the year. As I'm guessing with most investors, I am quite heavily tilted towards shares. Is now a good time to introduce some bonds to my portfolio? I think it's a nice way of also sort of wrapping up the first bit of what we've been talking about this evening, Warren. But first, have a listen to Wentworth.
Good evening, gentlemen. I just wanted to say a huge fan of the show and thank you for taking the time to address my question. In summary, I just wanted to go through about 5 points. I stick to a monthly budget. I have my insurances in place, estate planning. I have a trust, a company, and I purchased their property through that company. My wife is currently also consulting and invoicing through the company at this stage. So we have one property in the portfolio, looking to grow it, but I do understand Warren has some ideas about that, and I'm also re-looking at that myself. Estate planning wise, sorry, I just mentioned that. Retirement planning, I've got an RA with a company called 10X. I find their fees to be reasonably low. I'm in a high equity fund, and there's about 1.1 bar in there at this stage. Tax-free savings account is again with a company called ETFSA. And there I'm putting the monthly 3K a month away. Emergency fund is set at about 240K. I have no consumer debt or cars, motorbikes. Everything is paid off. We are renting. I used to own, got out of that. That was a big mess. Don't want to rent. I don't want to own until I found our forever home. And so I believe fully what Warren says about 8 to 10 years, then I will look at a place. And when we do, it'll be a place with a kind of a granny flat so that we can obviously rent that out at a later stage should someone pass away or an opportunity comes up to use our liability as an asset, so to speak. My big question, guys, is that my father recently passed away. I've come into a little bit of money. I'm looking at about a bar or 900K. That's after I take my emergency fund out. My big question is, I'm a fan of easy equities. I'm a fan of ETFs. I do like individual stocks. However, I'm not smart enough or have the time to do that yet. I just wanted to know, what would be the best strategy to Rand cost average in with the, say, 860, 900K over the next few months? I know that the markets are in a bit of a downturn. And with that in mind, I'm not trying to catch the bottom, but I also am not sure if I should put in 50,000 Rand. I know that I should do something like a diversified portfolio, so like a Satrix top 40, 50, or 60 perhaps.
Okay, Wentworth, I've never had a more detailed self-analysis, and it's impressive. Please don't do that again. It's lovely. It really is good for context, but we do need to get through more content this evening. So I think we've got a very nice picture of it, and I'm so grateful that you sent the question, Wentworth, because you are very disciplined. Warren can give us a quick analysis of that in a moment. I love how you say, I am not smart enough to go and buy individual shares. Just forget that. You know, and for the vast majority of us, I think that's the case. It's because we don't have the time and the energy and the aptitude for it. So I think you're spot on that particular front. But yeah, so very thoughtful. Thank you. We'll analyze it in just a moment. Wentworth, love to hear from you again. Shorter messages, please. That goes for everyone. But good one. Thank you, Wentworth.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa CIB. To gain data-driven insights on consumer behavior in African markets, tune into the Absa Insight Series podcast. That's Africanacity. Absa is an authorized FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
I think Wentworth's very detailed question, Warren, went to the core of what we're talking about going towards 2023 and how he's magnificently disciplined and is so well structured across so many aspects, but has got this small windfall which is coming in his way, and I'm sure he's grateful to his dad for leaving him 900,000 rand or thereabouts, and he's thinking exactly the right way about how to apply that money, isn't he?
Can I just say, I think we should have an hour show just dedicated to Wentworth. I mean, what a fabulous set of circumstances. He's listened to our show for years. He's disciplined, rigorous, and it's fantastic. I was so happy to hear that question. I was sad that you stopped it. I know why you did, but gee, we should get him back, Bruce. So
I haven't got time. There's not enough time. No shame. Thank you, Wentworth. We're grateful.
So let's look at the situation. I mean, I think when you've got a lump sum and the markets are down and we don't know where the bottom is, we never will until it's already passed. The one big decision there is, do you phase the money in? So do you feed it in equal portions over a period of time? I think that makes a lot of sense to me. I wouldn't go and invest the whole 900,000 into the markets in one shot. I would feed it in. The debate is then how long, Wentworth, and my suggestion when we've had such a big drop in markets all around the world is you know, don't do it over 12 months, which would, you know, be my kind of normal idea. I think you can actually use the low market value. So I think the price earnings ratio of the market is good, and therefore choose somewhere around 3 to 6 months. You know, so you take that, for argument's sake, you take 900,000 divided by six, whatever that is per month, put that into the markets in equal amounts for the 6 month period. And then because Wentworth's got a business and a property investment in South Africa, I think he's got to kind of build up the global exposure as well. So by all means, you know, buy the top 40 index with a portion of the money and do it equally. But I would say maybe do 2/3 global and 1/3 local. In other words, you know, take 600,000. I hope my maths is right, Bruce, and put 600,000 into the world markets and do that, you know, 100 a month. And then take 300,000 and put that into the top 40 and do that at 50 a month. And I think that would be a really nice strategy for the next 5-10 years. As you said, the markets might go down, but you are going to be buying, you know, both the local and global markets, I think, at very good PE ratios. So I don't think you regret the decision a decade from now. You might be very unhappy in 6 months from now, but that's okay.
There are very few things worse than losing money, but losing money that's been left as a bequest to you, I think it takes on an additional level of responsibility. You feel responsible not only to yourself and your own future, but you feel responsible to the person who left it to you to treat it with the respect that it deserves. I mean, here's somebody who made sacrifices in their life to make sure that you had something once they were gone, and you've got to respect that, don't you?
And I mean, just listen to Wentworth. I mean, I just want to kind of put him in boxes and sell him, you know, and kind of whatever that magic is, that fairy dust that he's got, let's take the Wentworth dust and pass it along to everyone else, because he's got it absolutely down pat. No debt. You know, he's got the renting thing. I mean, the only comment there, which was, I mean, I think he understands, but just for our listeners is, you know, buy the house that you're going to stay in for 8 to 10 years or longer. So don't wait 8 to 10 years. It's just buy the house that you plan to stay in. But I mean, gee, you can hear Bruce, he's been listening to us for years and it's all landed, and he's taken the good and he's ignored whatever rubbish we might have said along the way by accident. So I'm so chuffed with that. I promise you, it's made my day.
Wonderful. I'm so glad to make your day, Warren. Well, Wentworth made your day. I didn't. And then the other question we've got, which is kind of similar, I suppose. My portfolio, local and offshore, has taken quite a knock since the start of the year. I'm guessing, as with most investors, I'm quite heavily tilted towards shares. Is now a good time to introduce some bonds into my portfolio?
So I mean, just to explain, the role of bonds is it's in most instances, except for the first 6 months of this year, it's a very nice diversifier away from shares. So in most market conditions, when the stock market goes down, bonds will tend to hold their value or sometimes even go up. Because of inflation and what's going on with interest rates, that didn't work this year. But that's not to say it doesn't work again in the future. So bonds are there to help as a stabilizer in a portfolio, but they're not going to be a massive source of capital growth. And your biggest source of capital growth will be shares. So I think for people that have got a very long time horizon, you know, we're talking 10 years and longer, having a large weighting in shares makes sense. And then having a smaller weighting in bonds does make sense to me. I think it is a good call. I wouldn't be too kind of market timey about it. In other words, don't say, well, conditions are now that I'll go from cash into bonds and then maybe out of bonds again. I think it make it as a structural decision, but certainly, you know, interest rates, I mean, as we said earlier, they might not be peaked yet, but they will be peaking in the next while, you know, whether it's 6 months or a year, who knows. And that will be when bond prices will stop falling, I guess. And so, yes, do add some bonds to your portfolio, but do it gradually. And especially global bonds, you know, I mean, someone described global bonds for quite a few years as return-free risk. And that was a very prescient statement. I think, you know, we've seen it now. But I think that story might be over and they might start to deliver some growth, both in the form of income and maybe a bit of capital growth. So sure, add the bonds. SA bonds are a good investment. They have been for quite some time. So I don't mind the bonds. Just don't overweight bonds at the cost of the stock market, which is your engine of growth as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and it's really important. I mean, people, again, people say, oh, Warren, you can't buy South African bonds. South Africa's going bankrupt. And South Africa was at risk of going bankrupt. Certainly 2 or 3 years ago, it felt very, very close to the edge. And of course, you never say never. But, you know, adults are in charge. The politics of South Africa is fraught and complicated and messy, but I think we've had some indications of perhaps some greater stability for the next foreseeable future anyway. And, you know, our debt levels are rising, but as a percentage of GDP are calming a little bit down to below 75%. Just a couple of slightly more positive indicators. They're not good indicators, but they're more positive than they were 2 or 3 years ago when the doomsayers were telling us to run for the hills.
And, you know, and very interesting that if you look at some of the fund managers that are sort of accustomed to swimming against the tide, you know, they were loading up on some of the government bonds a couple of years ago because they really liked the yield that you could get, you know. So when you bought it, you're kind of locking in maybe 10 or 11% interest on the capital that you put in. And you know, that shouldn't, you shouldn't dismiss that kind of interest in a fund. And I think we're in that space now for a lot of individuals. I mean, I'm looking at RSA retail bonds, they're offering very good rates. You know, just be careful of the income tax you're going to pay. But I agree, Bruce. I mean, I think, you know, being totally pessimistic about the prospects of the country kind of going over the cliff, I think it's not right to say that. The country will be able to fund its debt for quite some time, even if the policies go bad again. And I agree with you. I think we're incrementally getting better day by day. SARS is certainly doing a better job all the time. And I think we need to look at those things as good for the bond market and good for the government's ability to pay its bonds for the next while.
Thank you, Warren Ingram, Executive Director at Galileo Capital. He's a personal financial advisor and fanboy number one of tonight's big question.